I think we can go ahead and get started here. Thank you all very much for coming. Could we have the roll call, please?
On the roll for the Advisory Council meeting of December 11th, 2017, Professor Bornstein, Dr. Littman.
Here.
Dr. Long.
Here.
Dr. Kleinman, Mr. Hayes.
Here.
Director Sinks, we do not have a quorum.
Okay, well, thank you very much. You may be sitting here wondering why we're having this meeting. We are statutorily obligated to have 4 meetings a year. We postponed a meeting for good, solid reasons in July, I think. So we are short a meeting. So we are having a meeting today to satisfy our statutory obligations. The 3 of us are here. A 4th of ours, technically a quorum, but not really because he's not physically here. Professor Michael Kleinman is watching via video today. So thank you all for coming. The topics that we're going to be talking today are very important. We have some very interesting speakers who will be talking to us. We're pleased you could join us, and we're going to launch into that. It's possible that we may finish somewhat short of our usual schedule. I wanted to make sure that I wished you all a belated happy holiday wishes, and it seemed like there'd been a lot of holidays, so I checked. Thanksgiving Day, Veterans Day, Black Friday, Cyber Monday, Giving Tuesday, National Pizza Day, Guy Fawkes Day, and last but not least, World Toilet Day. What? So congratulations and holiday. No, I didn't. I
looked. Guess you can't make that up.
That's not something you can make up. But I wanted to be the first to, or maybe not the first, but to wish you all happy holidays and a happy new year as we go forward for the rest of the year here. Thanks. I want to issue a couple of reminders here that I do at each meeting. This meeting today is webcast, so please use the microphone and be careful to make sure that you speak into it. We're going to break for lunch and finish, and as I said, probably earlier today than usual. There are 2 opportunities for public comment if you're here for that. At the beginning of our meeting shortly, there'll be opportunities to speak on the agenda items, matters that are on the agenda. Then toward the end of the meeting, there'll be another opportunity for anyone who would like to speak from the public regarding matters that are not on our agenda. So with that, let me mention just a few words about what we're going to be doing today. There are 2 presentations that we'll be fortunate enough to hear. There's an update from staff on adopted Rule 1118, which reduces risks from toxic emissions at existing facilities here in the Bay Area. Secondly, we'll have an update from the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, OEHA, describing for us studies of short-term PM2.5 exposures here in California. Both of these updates are to inform our deliberations about where we go from here. The Advisory Council's next area of focus, as we've talked about in our previous meetings, is beyond attainment. As we move to attainment of national and state ambient air quality standards, what do we do? Are we there? Are we finished? And the answer obviously is no. As we decide what it is that we're going to recommend perhaps the district do as its next steps, the question comes up how we most move the public health needle. We talked about that a lot at our last meeting. We're going to hear more about that today. What are the next best things to do, especially for those who live in disproportionately impacted communities? The common denominator in all of this, which we talked about last time, is PM, particulate matter. Particulate matter drives the risk both for criteria pollutants and air toxics, and because of that, it seems to us to be the clue to how to realize the further health improvement that the Bay Area needs and deserves. So building on the presentations at our last meeting today, the ones you'll hear today, lay out for us more the issues that Melanie Marty from OEHA talked about at our last meeting and Dr. Kleinman, who spoke to us about the complexity of PM health effects. So with that as prelude, I'm going to skip the approval of the minutes today. Since we don't have a quorum, we're not able to do that. I'd like to open the floor now to public comment on any of the agenda matters. Is there anyone here who would like to speak today about that? You're welcome to if you are here. All right. Then in that case, let's move on. At this point, I'd like to ask Jack, I wonder if you have a report for us today.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I believe under item number seven.
Jack, could I hold just a second? I realize I've done a very bad thing. Would you please just stand with me and let's pledge allegiance to the flag? My apologies. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. Thank you. Jack.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is number seven on the agenda. You're going to move that up, I think.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, Greg, we're going to move number seven first. Okay, Marcy? Okay. But thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Advisory Council. Thank you for moving this item up. I wish I could attend the entire meeting with you, but I do have to have another commitment across the Bay Area here this morning. So under my remarks, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to provide you with a little bit of a summary of the activities of the district here in the last several months. And as we wrap up this year, this is a time in which we often sit down with our governing board, review also this last year's accomplishments, which have been many. And I thought I would just review for the Advisory Council some of the highlights of this last year. This last spring, we adopted our clean air climate plan that was a very critical planning effort on behalf of the district that sets forth not only our regulatory agenda, but really lays out our programs as it relates to further making progress in terms of reducing greenhouse gases, climate change precursors, but also moves us forward with regard to achieving our state and ambient air quality standards for ozone, PM. And then it also lays out a whole series of actions in order to be able to address the disparities in the Bay Area as it relates to disproportionately impacted communities. And so it's a very important plan and something we're very proud of. As this advisory council knows, though, we've also spent a considerable amount of time dealing with 1216, which was a proposed rule to cap the refineries. And ultimately, in the end, during the summer, a key set of legislative initiatives, namely AB 398, was chaptered, and that bill removes the district's authority in terms of preventing us from essentially taking steps to reduce CO2 from cap sources. And we have interpreted that to mean that we cannot move forward in terms of proposed Rule 1216. I just wanted to also mention, though, and you're going to hear about it, on November 15th, the board adopted 1118, which was a very important regulation that will essentially require the major stationary sources to meet a very aggressive risk management target of 10 in a million. We believe that's long been what makes sense with regard to protecting vulnerable communities from major stationary sources, and indeed the Advisory Council has been along with us in terms of making those recommendations as well to the Governing Board. And so I'm not going to steal any thunder from Mr. Nutt. I know he's going to give you a presentation here this morning on that. What I wanted to talk a little bit about, though, well, to wrap up this year, we have actually a set of meetings, namely some additional committee meetings the rest of this year in December. But I did want to mention that the Governing Board will move into its retreat on January 17th. It's going to be holding that retreat in San Ramon, which is the incoming chair, Dave Hudson's city. And we invite the Advisory Council to attend if you'd like to. And we can send you more information about that, Mr. Chairman. I did want to talk, though, about the Advisory Council very specifically, and the fact that the terms of the Advisory Council members is actually coming to a close in terms of you all were appointed for two-year terms, if you recall. And I know it's been a whirlwind time and experience the last couple of years, but your terms are coming up to a close. And I thought I would walk you through what we're thinking about in terms of as staff and in terms of to the board. You're appointed into these positions by our governing board. And so I just wanted to mention essentially what we're thinking in terms of how we proceed. You have 7 members of the advisory council, 2 of which have indicated to us that they are electing not to necessarily continue to serve on the advisory council. That is Dr. Bob Harley and Tam Dudek. And so that leaves 2 vacancies. And keep in mind as we proceed forward, I wanted to let you all know that there's been a number of different members of the public asking that we open up the advisory council for a process by which we would have all the positions interviewed. That is something that as staff we have elected to take the step in my conversations with the board. They would like to see a process put forward that I would like to explain a little bit for all of you that are here. And for those that are not here, I suspect we're going to end up communicating with them separately. So I thought what would make sense, first of all, is that we'll have a personnel committee convened and so that we could interview potential candidates to serve in the advisory council, Mr. Chairman. And I would ask that you help participate in that effort. We would go through the process of inviting members of the public if they would like to serve and call that down in terms of potential candidates and then have that personnel committee conduct a series of interviews similar to what we do with regard to our hearing board that also is a separate entity of the district. But that's a process that works well, and I thought it could be utilized here to select an additional for the vacancies that are occurring with the advisory council. For the remainder, we thought that it makes sense for us to have a conversation with the board. And very specifically, I wanted to just mention this to you. We're going to call for a meeting of the executive committee of our board, meeting with the advisory council, meaning the 5 members of the advisory council that are remaining, and to essentially sit down and talk about, as the advisory council defines for itself, the topics by which it wants to cover in 2018, to have that conversation with the board, and specifically the executive committee of the board. The executive committee of our board is made up of primarily the chairs of the different committees, and it's essentially the leadership of the governing board. And I think this is a step that I think makes sense given the discussion and dialogue we had at our last advisory council, wherein that there was some conversation about whether, in terms of just, is the deliberations, the result of the deliberations, the advisory council being communicated with the governing board? Is it making sure that they're both entities are in sync? And this is an approach that I think makes sense for us to proceed in the sense that having the advisory council sit down with the executive committee in the first quarter of next year to really have a conversation about what you plan to deliberate, what you plan to discuss, and how that fits in with where the governing board and their thinking about where we ought to be moving forward and proceeding. And so that would occur after the retreat, and I think it makes a lot of sense for us to move in this direction. And so let me pause there, Mr. Chairman, and answer any questions for you.
Well, Jack, I know that it's the end of the year, and reflecting back on our year as well as our full 2 years, it has struck me that there are a number of things that that we can do to interact more efficiently, effectively with the board, things that bring us in contact so that we can talk, get to know each other. All of those things are, I think, exceedingly important. I think this is a real resource that the district has. It's a real resource that the board has. And our job here is to try to get the science as best we can and then to convey that in a way that's understandable to the board, that helps the board and you to move forward. So I think anything that increases that interaction, I think it's great to have a conversation with the board, with the executive committee of the board. I think it's great to, I've got a couple of things on my list here. I'd like to see us as an agenda item at the board retreat, and it sounds like that's something that you're thinking of doing. I think that'll help. I think it's important to reinstitute, if the board would like it, quarterly reports. We used to do that to the executive committee. That's something that I wonder if the board would consider reinstituting. I think that would be helpful, getting to know each other better and what we're doing. I think that I'd like to see some sort of a mechanism in place for the board to ask questions. I think it's, as we come to opinions, as we offer our advice, it seems entirely fitting that the board put us, all of us, some of us, me perhaps, or whoever the chair is at the time, on the hot seat to ask, to justify and explain what our decision is, why we got to where we got, why we believe the science supports the positions that we're recommending to you. That mechanism, however we think works most efficiently, I think it would be a very good idea, and it would help to go beyond the report that we prepare in explaining the basis for our opinions. And I'd like, while I understand that there are Brown Act considerations, it would be nice if at some point there was an opportunity for some sort of social interaction with the board, so that more informal basis, we can again get to know each other. So there's a whole palette of steps that I think will help to learn more about the considerations that the board has, and for them to understand us and our qualifications, and our what we can bring to bear to help. So, seen in that kind of context, it seems to me that a conversation with the board makes sense. One question: Are you thinking about interviews for I assume for the two seats that are open?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. So there's been just to add more to this conversation a little bit. If I'm not being as clear as I should be, I apologize. It's a lot going on here this morning. But so there's a number of members of the public that have asked for there to be greater representation from environmental community, environmental justice community representatives. So that is part of the flavor that has been of some of the public comments to the governing board. I want to make sure the advisory council knows and hears that. We haven't necessarily heard the comment that there ought to be greater representation from the business community, but I suspect as we move into this process, we'll probably hear that comment. So I guess part of me wants to make sure, at least for the three of you, you're comfortable with the approach we're laying out here for you. I think your comment, Mr. Chairman, about quarterly reports to the board, I think that's a great idea. Let me look to try to institutionalize that in terms of on a quarterly basis. That makes a lot of sense. The reason why we suggest the executive committee is largely because that's the leadership of the governing board, and it makes sense for you to be, I think, engaged with the board at that level. It's a little bit difficult for us to try to schedule a regular item on the full board meeting because there's just so much business that goes through the district. So that's the next best thing, I think, is the executive committee. So I think in part I'm also just asking whether this process makes a little bit sense for all of you, I hope. And that would mean that we'll schedule a formal meeting between the advisory council and the executive committee first quarter of next year to really just talk about it's, if you will, a goal setting discussion. It's, I would suggest it makes sense once the governing board has its retreat and they hear from staff about laying out some of the key important initiatives we have underway, not the least of which includes 617. I think if you need me to cover that, I can, but that's the new bill that really calls for a lot of work down at trying to address disproportionately impacted communities. That's going to be a large part of our efforts next year. But I suspect once the board has had that retreat, they're going to be more comfortable asking questions to the advisory council. And it's going to fit in very nicely, I think, with your whole discussion about where, in terms of looking at beyond attainment, looking at the impacts of PM at the local community level. And they're going to be asking you questions for you all to be, I think, to be inserted in kind of your future deliberations for 2018. And so that's kind of how I thought it would proceed. With regard to the interviews, I was going to open that up, Mr. Chairman, just to the two, for the two positions, and seek to have the personnel committee conduct interviews and then make recommendations to the full board.
Question?
Jane?
Yeah, just it seemed like you invited the advisory committee to the retreat, which was January 17th.
Right.
And would that not be a wonderful opportunity to have some of this informal interaction? No.
Well, I think my attorney would tell me that you can't necessarily have this informal conversation. Yes, you're a Brown Act committee, so I don't know if we can necessarily.
Right. I mean, I think there's a possibility in off moments, but it's not on the agenda, certainly, and you wouldn't be participating in the meeting in that sense.
Okay, so it's just observe. If you go, you're just observing.
Right.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Any other questions? All right. Well, Jack, thank you very much. I think that this is a path on which I think we're moving that I think will result in better interaction with our board. I think it'll give us a chance to to have more contact, more substantive contact. This first 2 years of this new council's configuration, I think was a learning period. I think for us to learn where we are and what we do, I think it's also the board having to learn about us, and I think we have more to do to further that. So, to the extent this gives us some progress on that, I think it's a good sound approach. Are we okay with this? Okay. All right, Jack. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that we have a request for speaker for item 7. However, that would be an agenda matter.
Yes.
And I believe we've already.
I'm happy to revisit that if that's all
okay.
Right.
I mean, yeah. Okay, great.
When we're finished with Jack's report.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think that covers it. I think, as I look at my item, my notes, I think that's probably the major topics. I wanted to talk about the fact that that the Advisory Council has served the district well, and certainly has been a part of the deliberations for the board this past year. I did want to mention one last item for your edification here, is that Director Sinks is now in the rotation. He was selected as the secretary of the board. So that's an item that's occurred, I think maybe since your last board meeting or your last advisory council meeting. The board had a lot of conversation about this and was very impressed by his time and serving as an advisory council as the ex officio member of the chair, I believe, is his title. I think that's at least an indication of the board's, I think, desire to have the advisory council play an increasing role in its deliberations moving forward.
Great. Yeah, no, it's wonderful to have Rod as a member. I mean, I think the idea of having a member of the board sitting on this council as an ex officio member is great. it all moves in the direction of for that further communication that I think is so important for both of us and the board as well. So he does a fine job of that. So I'm glad to hear he's in the rotation. Good for him. Good for all of us, I think. Jack, you mentioned 617. Is there any update on any of that you need and want to talk about?
So we're going to talk to the governing board quite a bit about it. This is a bill that it's not necessarily on your agenda, but it flows. Your work in defining beyond attainment, really just taking a look at where the district needs to build into its work in dealing with communities. So if I take a step back, 617 was a companion bill to AB 398. So when the governor signed AB 398 to extend the cap and trade program from 2020 to 2030, it was critical to get a number of legislators on board to really address what they believe is part of the forgotten equation in the cap and trade program, and that is the impacts down at the very local level to those communities that happen to be adjacent to a major stationary source. So as they trade under the cap and trade program, there's a real concern that their emissions of toxic air contaminants and other pollutants might increase, or certainly not go down as fast as it could and should be relative to implementing the statewide implementation plan. And so 617 was a bill that requires the local air districts working in close coordination with CARB to identify impacted communities and then essentially establish an air monitoring network inside those communities to understand what people are exposed to, and then put together a plan with local community input, meaning stakeholder input, a ground up type of an approach, and then implementing that plan over time to reduce localized exposures. I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, that we agendize that for a future meeting of the Advisory Council, because the deadlines in that bill and that are very ambitious. We have to identify communities, I believe, by next in draft form next May or March, if I recall, and then by August have a finalized list, and at the same time starting to put in place an air monitoring network. Luckily, the Bay Area is, I think, ahead of most areas of California through our CARE program, our Community Air Risk Evaluation program that the Advisory Council's had presentations of in the past. And so I think we're in a better place. Nevertheless, there's a lot of ambitious goals here. Another part of that bill calls for us to identify best available retrofit control technology of the CAP sources or BART requirements. And that reprioritizes our rulemaking calendar quite a bit. And we're still undertaking that effort. And I don't believe we have to submit that BARC schedule until, I'll look at Greg, before the end of 2018. So, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot to this bill. I would suggest that we bring it back to you. We plan to talk to our full board meeting just about what this calls for. Just to give you a sense of the impact to the district, we're proposing that we go back to the board and do a mid-year augmentation of the staff by adding another 5 staff just to do air monitoring work, but amongst other things as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, no. Yeah, I very much would like to see it back on our agenda at the next meeting, perhaps, if that works. I think this is such an important overlay on the discussion that we're having about beyond attainment, understanding what is being done and needs to be done to help disproportionately impacted communities is just a hugely important thing for all of us to understand. So bringing it back is great. Thank you. Let me depart from the agenda a little bit and move back a second time, and let's move back to the opportunity for public comment. If there's anyone who would like to speak on agenda items here, they're certainly welcome to come up and do it.
Thank you, Bob Brown.
Thank you very much for coming.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Hayes and members. Bob Brown with Western States Petroleum Association. Just very briefly, just wanted to register on behalf of our membership our interest, and I really appreciate the fact that there's going to be additional collaboration throughout the year between the advisory council and the board of directors. We greatly respect the diversity on this board, the expertise, and looking at the complexity of the rules that comes before us in the Air District that we deal with. And I definitely would welcome the opportunity on behalf of our membership to put forward some names for consideration for those vacancies. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks. Anyone else? Okay, let's go back on the agenda. Our next item of business is going to be the presentation from staff on adopted rule 1118. And Greg, sorry for calling you up prematurely. Thanks very much for coming today. And Jeff, do you want to introduce this topic and Greg?
Absolutely. Greg is a recently appointed Deputy Air Pollution Control Officer and was very much responsible for getting this rule passed. And so now we're talking about how we're going to move forward since it has, in fact, passed. Greg?
And Greg, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm not sure. I think it's a combination of congratulations and condolences, but we'll see how it plays out. Chair Hayes and members of the committee, I'm going to give you guys kind of an in-depth review of Regulation 11, Rule 18, which reduces toxic risk from existing facilities. Go over a quick background, talk about toxic air contaminants, then Rule 11, 18 requirements implementation, follow up with some key points. So this has been on our agenda for a while. The 2010 Clean Air Act included a plan to update the Toxic Hotspots Program. In 2015, OEHA, who you'll hear from later today, updated their statewide guidance on health risk assessment and reassessed a lot of the our understanding of the risk of these contaminants. And then in 2016, the first thing we did was we updated the permitting rules to make sure that we were using the current air toxics science in those permitting rules. And we spent a lot of time doing outreach to impact stakeholders in 2016 and 2017, multiple presentations to the board and stationary source committee. And we finally brought this to the board of directors on November 15th of 2017. So I'm going to go over toxic air contaminants. It's important to recognize that toxic air contaminants is a regulatory creature. These are defined in the California Health and Safety Code. There's more than 200 compounds. The hazards to human health include cancer, non-cancer, chronic health impacts, and acute health impacts. Here's some example toxic air contaminants and their associated health impacts. Chromium-6, for example, impacts the lungs and the respiratory system. It's primarily a chronic problem. Benzene, which is ubiquitous in our gasoline-driven economy, has known carcinogen, has chronic and acute impacts. The largest impact that we see from an air toxic standpoint, though, is from diesel exhaust, and that's really what we see in these overburdened communities as being the prime driver of toxic risk. Taking into account the health impacts of toxic air emissions, you have to look at the emission rate, how that is dispersed in the atmosphere to be an ambient concentration, and then how that is taken in by people, and then you can assess the potential damage to health. And OEHA develops the guidelines both for doing the modeling to convert to the ambient concentration and the exposure and toxicity guidelines as well. So we measure impacts through cancer risk. That's the theoretical probability of contracting cancer, assuming a lifetime exposure to the substance. The acute hazard index is the potential non-cancer health impacts from a one-hour exposure, and the chronic hazard index depends on the particular substance. Bay Area lifetime cancer risk from toxic air contaminants has improved greatly since 1990. We've seen a huge drop in the estimated risk, and this is from monitored data. So this is what we're actually measuring in our air toxics monitoring network, adjusted for toxicity and exposure assumptions under the OEHA guidelines, under the current OEHA guidelines. Even though we've made great progress across the area, we're seeing that a lot of communities were not making nearly enough progress. In fact, if you look at it, the disparity is actually increased because the general population is now exposed to a much lower overall cancer risk, whereas in these areas concentrated along the 880 corridor and the port activities and eastern San Francisco, we're still seeing very high cancer risk, predominantly due to diesel PM. Reminder of the regulatory authority, the Bay Area has primacy over stationary sources only. State Air Resources Board has regulatory authority over mobile sources, although we do quite a bit of work in the mobile source area with our grants program. And then EPA retains the authority for interstate and international transport. Rule 1118 fits into the big scope of our toxic air control, toxic air contaminant control programs, including the hotspots program, CEQA reviews, stationary source control measures, and the CARE program, which was mentioned earlier today. So now I'm going to drill down into Rule 1118 specifically. The idea behind Rule 1118 is that it reduces toxic risk in overburdened communities. It's a good foundation for our AB 617 implementation. It reduces toxic risk to lowest achievable levels and allows the facilities to set their own compliance paths. Right now, our risk action threshold in our legacy AB 2588 program is 100 in a million. Adopted Rule 1118 will drop it to 25 in a million in 2018 and 10 in a million in 2020. And the little call-out box there shows you the equivalent acute and chronic hazard indices. So when I'm referring to 25 in a million versus 10 in a million, that also takes into account the change in the chronic hazard indices. The short time period between the drop down to 25 and the drop down to 10 is to enable us to focus on the highest risk facilities and also to get those facilities that might be between 10 and 25 a little bit of time to make changes to maybe avoid being roped into the program altogether. So the process is we review the emissions inventory with the facility. We develop a health risk assessment, also in close coordination with the facility. And then the results of that health risk assessment are what triggers Rule 1118 or not. Any facility that has a risk action level greater, has an HRA result with a risk action level greater than the greater than the action level. They need to develop a risk reduction plan for air district approval and execute that plan according to schedule. One of the options that we are allowing for in this regulation is if the facility cannot meet the risk action level, they are expected to do everything feasible. And everything feasible falls under the umbrella of best available retrofit control technology for toxics, which is a concept that we invented for the purposes of this rule to make sure that facilities that legitimately could not get below the risk action levels had a path forward where we could assure the community that everything that could be done was being done. Some other options that we see in some facilities, especially backup generators, modification of operating hours and activity levels, and modification of the stack parameters. We're exempting retail gas stations initially. We're still working with the state and CAPCOA on the emission factors for those gas stations. We want to make sure that we've got the right benzene numbers going into these analyses. We've also exempted the sites that have only emergency backup generators and have a risk screening level less than 250. So some of the larger data centers will still be incorporated into this, but a lot of the mom and pop emergency backup generators are exempted at this time. We are currently working on a rule that focuses on these small emergency backup generators and might take a different approach for those than we're taking in 1118. So here's kind of the universe of the potential risk reduction measures. It really depends on what is causing the problem in the HRA. If you've got a diesel source next to the fence line and you can move it, well, that'll make a big difference. There's some, in some cases, there's options to use alternative fuels and materials, increase stack heights, change the operating times, and of course, install control technology. So as I said before, this is the overall process, prioritize the facilities, validate the data, conduct the HRA, public process on the HRA, publish the results of the HRA to the website. We think that for each kind of set of facilities, that's going to be a 6 to 18 month process. We anticipate completing the high priority facilities by the end of 2019 and the remaining facilities by the end of 2021. And that would be just the completion of the analysis. Subsequently, they would have time to prepare their risk reduction plans. There'll be a public comment process on the risk reduction plans. And then the facilities are expected to implement those risk reduction plans within 5 years. But we recognize in some cases it may take longer than 5 years. For example, a refinery that has to install control equipment that it can't install unless they're shut down may have to wait until their next maintenance turnaround to install that equipment. So kind of reviewing the key points of 1118, some health protective standards, flexible methods of compliance, and the implementation approach. We'll go into that in a minute as well. So probably the key point of controversy in this rule was the 10 in a million risk action level. We believe this is the most health protective one achievable. It's in place at other air districts in the state of California. We looked at preliminary HRAs and HRAs that we've completed as part of the New Source Review Program over the past several years. And we believe that for our facilities, this is technically achievable for the vast majority of them. It addresses smaller sources, which can be cumulatively significant in care areas. You start exempting these small sources and you find yourself in a situation where you have clusters of small sources that are cumulatively significant to their neighbors. Our analysis indicates that this more restrictive health standard will benefit at least 10 times more people than the 25 in a million level set at South Coast. And a preliminary HRA for one refinery shows thousands of people benefit from the 10 in a million, but only hundreds benefit from the 25 in a million. Here's where we are, kind of baseline on the HRA results. Most folks are in the 10 to 25 range. We recognize somebody that's up at 56 right now may not be able to get down to 10, but that's why we've got the TBARC option for sources like that. So here's a case study of the 25 in a million versus 10 in a million. So if we had set the risk action level at 25 in a million, only those three facilities indicated on this map would have to be reviewed under this regulation. At 10 in a million, all of those facilities would have to be reviewed. And you can see around the port there is a kind of a concentration of these moderately risk, high-risk facilities that combined would be significant. We also did a case study of looking at HRA results for an oil refinery, and we drew IsoPlus for the 10 in a million and 25 in a million and saw how those intersected census blocks. So at the less stringent risk action threshold, the 25 in a million, only about the 600 people in those blue census blocks would benefit. At the 10 in a million, everybody benefits. So all of the orange census blocks and the green icons there indicate daycare centers, some of which fall within populated areas and some of which do not. We want to make sure that we looked at that as this analysis. We also looked at hospitals and schools, but none of them fell into this particular map. Here's a cement kiln. At 25 in a million, the facility would not have to make any changes. At 10 in a million, about 1,500 people benefit, and that's the orange shaded area. And this is kind of, since these are census blocks, some of those big blocks may only have one or two houses on them, because that's the wildland interface in Cupertino. Facilities can choose the lowest cost approach to get below 10 in a million. And for some facilities, it may be pretty straightforward to do that. Facilities are able to get more time to install controls if they can demonstrate it's not technically feasible or economically reasonable to install within 5 years. And if they truly cannot get down below 10 in a million, they are required to install best available retrofit control technology for toxics on all significant sources in their facility. Major sources will be addressed first in our analysis to make sure that we have captured the worst case operator, the highest emission sources initially in the analysis. So backing up a bit, as you recall the initial slide about toxic air contaminants, we think that Rule 1118 is necessary but not sufficient, because what's really driving health risks from air pollution in the Bay Area is fine PM. And this chart compares diesel PM, ozone, undifferentiated PM, and toxics in terms of mortality, cancer onset, hospital admissions, non-fatal heart attacks, and asthma emergency room visits. So, as I said before, we consider 1118 to be necessary, to be stringent, to be very helpful in addressing concerns from air pollution, especially in overburdened communities, but we don't think that we can just stop there. So the next steps, of course, is to implement Rule 1118, starting with the highest polluting facilities. For those smaller facilities, focused on those that are in overburdened areas already. Through modeling and monitoring, work towards a neighborhood scale understanding of ambient PM 2.5 levels. Right now, we've got a really good regional scale understanding of PM 2.5 levels, but when you drill down to the neighborhoods, our monitoring network and our methodologies need to be improved. We want to identify opportunities to reduce PM 2.5 through direct regulation and mobile source grant programs, and we also want to evaluate the possibility of a rule analogous to 1118 for PM 2.5. That's it.
Great, thank you very, very much. Do you have any questions, folks?
I have sort of an off-the-wall question. Are there exposures of interest that come about because of home heating with methane? You know, a lot of people have these little wall furnaces with burn, you know, that produce hot air heat.
Not that I'm aware of. I would expect CO to be a potential problem in that case, right? Carbon monoxide.
Right.
I think that one toxic air contaminant that is always on the list, but we don't talk about a whole lot, is formaldehyde, which is a product of incomplete combustion and methane combustion, and that's ubiquitous because of all of the methane combustion that we have and water heating and space heating and things like that. It's a relatively low toxicity compound, though.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your question is more to indoor air quality, which is kind of out of my particular expertise.
I just think home heating is a extremely interesting problem from many perspectives. So I was just wondering if it also had a toxic exposure element to it, but not necessarily.
Formaldehyde for sure.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
And. Right.
Tim?
Yeah, I just had a question, and this might not be something you can really answer because it may be too general, but looking at your slide on the Richmond care area, where when you lowered the threshold, there were, looked like maybe three facilities that were the blue pins. This is slide 24 if you wanted to bring it up. Yeah. There were the three facilities that would have been impacted at the 25 level, and then at the 10 level, there's many more facilities that are now being addressed. Is it possible to generalize kind of what types of facilities those additional facilities are? I assume the blue ones are large oil refinery type facilities. Are these additional oil refinery facilities, or they tend to be cement, you know, other industrial activities, or what's kind of getting caught up in this now that you've lowered the threshold? Curious.
It's typically other industrial activities is the majority of it. But I wouldn't want to, I'd have to go back and look at my maps and see what those are.
Yeah, no,
but in this case, for this Richmond example, it's typically other industrial activities.
Okay, that's what I was curious about. Interesting. Thanks.
I had a question that's sort of similar to the same one you asked, Tim. If you look at slide 12, please. This shows a map of estimated risk in various parts of the Bay Area. Maybe that's the wrong one. It's the map that shows where we used to be and where we are today.
Yeah.
It's 10.
Yeah. 10. Okay, thank you. It's nice to see that things have changed as much as they have in 10 years. I mean, that really shows that the effectiveness of the measures that we're all taking. There does look to be now in the 2015 slide the I-80 corridor, you mentioned it, that's resistant. So if we're thinking about ways to move the needle for disproportionately impacted communities, this is a place we would look. So do you have any insights that you have as to what's driving the risk in this place? It looks transportation related just because of the way it's oriented, but I don't know that that's so.
Transportation and goods movement. Those are the big drivers. Yeah.
Is that, and do you have a sense movement as to how much of that is? I mean, is transportation and goods movement responsible for 20%, for 50%, 80%?
I think we would say that relative to the highest hotspot in that area, it's responsible for about 66 to 70% of the total emissions there, with the rest of the emissions being not goods movement or transportation, or not goods movement or heavy duty truck traffic, but the additional transportation stuff and some additional mobile sources of diesel particulate matter, like construction equipment and other things which may have localized impacts in places like San Francisco and West Oakland.
That kind of begs the question, if you're going after facilities, but the main problem is being caused by goods movement, then how, what are you going to do about the goods movement?
I think that the work we will do under AB 617 directs us to look at not only stationary sources, but mobile sources as well. In addition to what Jack had mentioned about AB 617, there were a couple of companion bills, one of which provided approximately $570 million to go after mobile sources of air pollution. So one of the ways that we're looking at that is providing grant funding to go after it, but we're also pushing the Air Resources Board for additional regulation in a number of different areas, for mobile sources, for ocean-going cargo vessels, for cargo handling equipment. So there's a suite of packages that they're envisioning, I think, over the next 10 years, and actually some additional regulation that needs to come into place up until 2023 that are specifically designed to target these emissions. If you look at the left-hand side of the slide here, the majority of these emissions reductions have been achieved through either the implementation of grant programs or the implementation of ARB's regulatory programs over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So it is those regulations and the grant funding that we're using to target this, but through the 617 process, we'll be zeroing in on some of these neighborhoods to see how the combination of those stationary and mobile emissions fit together, and then creating plans to essentially reduce them.
As I looked at this and thought about the information you had in slide 28, where you listed off the health impacts of various pollutants, it's hard. Well, it's pretty obvious from this that what's driving all of the or not all, but the large fraction of health impacts from air pollution in the Bay Area is the other PM2.5 category. So, and the health effect we're looking at is are not that cancer, as awful as that may be, but mortality from short-term exposure to particulates today or tomorrow, and seeing the effect within a few days. If you were to think back to that slide we were looking at before that showed the cancer risk concentrated in the Bay Area along that I-80 corridor, how would that map change if you looked at PM2.5?
Not much.
It's the same thing that's driving.
I would assume it would be the, my guess would be it's the same source. So I think you'll see, What would be different is that in the wintertime, we do have some problems with wood smoke and with transport from the San Joaquin Valley.
Right.
If you look at our overall PM2.5, our annual concentrations, the worst case are typically Vallejo, and because the water, the air is coming down the strait and out into the bay from San Joaquin Valley. And so we have some weather-related high PM exposures, but in terms of local sources, it comes back primarily to that list. I mean, right. to the map right. you saw before.
Am I reading this right? I mean, I look at this, and I guess this reminds me of a pie chart that we've seen various times over a number of years now, that has, for me, a surprisingly small slice that's coming from toxics, other than PM. It's hard to look at this and not think that the issue all boils down to making further progress to benefit people's health, that it all comes down to PM2.5. It all has to, I mean, that's the place where we're going to have to make the progress on this if we're going to do something to make a dent in our beyond attainment world.
Chair Hayes, I think that is an important point, although one of the things about AB 617 is very specifically to look at impacted communities and what is going on in that community.
Right.
It may largely be PM2.5, but it could well be other things. And so it's important to look at all the different impacts.
Yeah, no, I agree completely.
But
yeah,
I think
absolutely right. Yeah.
This is
yeah,
clear sure. that PM2.5 is something we need to continue to work on.
I keep
on.
Trying to triage, you know, to what is it, apply yeah. some sort of screen to all this. Where, yeah. you know, where is the light? I don't want to go look where the light's best. I want to go where the light's, where it's important. And this is saying that, I'm not saying toxics and ozone are not important. They are. They clearly are. But in terms of this metric, at least, it's fine particles.
I think
PM2.5 that really
you
really
have to be careful that you're not going to be surprised by things that you may not know about today. You know, what the chrome problem in Paramount in Southern California is a good example.
Yeah.
You know, and so as we go into the AB 617 world, we want to make sure that we're
right.
thinking
right.
about those things that may be a surprise to us that we don't see from our regional network right now.
Right, right, right. Other questions, folks? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. This is very helpful. Very helpful. Thank you. And again, congratulations on your new role. All right. Next item of business is an update from our colleagues at WEHA on short-term fine particle exposures, a timely topic. And I want to, Jeff, do you want to introduce our guests?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Hayes. We've been so grateful. Excuse me, for OEHA's willingness to participate with us in conversations about topics that are unfolding and therefore particularly interesting. So John Faust is branch chief for Air and Environmental Research and has traveled here today. Thank you very much. And John's going to introduce the speaker.
Welcome. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Good morning. I just wanted to take a moment to introduce myself since I wasn't able to attend your last meeting. As I was introduced, I'm John Faust and chief of the Air Community Environmental Research Branch in OEHA for the last couple of years. At your meeting, a few weeks ago, you heard from my colleagues, Melanie Marty, John Boudreau, and Keita Abisu, who's also here. Sort of introducing OEHA's role in the various air toxics and toxic air contaminant programs, as well as introducing you to some of the literature that's out there regarding the health effects of PM. And today we want to continue that with a presentation from Dr. Rupa Basu. She's been investigating relationships between air pollution, temperature, and various health effects, looking at morbidity, mortality, and birth outcomes in epidemiological studies over the last 20 years. We've been lucky to have her in our office the last 12 years. She came to us from the US EPA after she graduated from the Johns Hopkins Bloomsbury School of Public Health with her PhD, and before that her master's in public health from UCLA. She's very active publishing within our office, and she's going to share today some of the review of the work on short-term PM and adverse health outcomes, focusing on California studies. With that, I'll turn it over to Rupa for the presentation.
Thank you. Welcome. Nice to have you here today. Thanks for coming.
Well, thank you for having me, and John, thanks for the introduction. So as John mentioned, this is really a follow-up to some of the presentations that were done at the last council meeting and by my colleagues. This time I'm going to focus on PM2.5 and adverse health outcomes, and mainly in California. And I just want to point out that some of these studies are going to be really OEHA focused, and it's because our section, the air and climate epidemiology section, is really responsible for helping CARB develop standards for criteria air pollutants. And so when we're not helping with the criteria air pollutants, we're conducting studies in California using California data, and that's actually just in an effort to strengthen our support of our standards. So how do I advance here? Right here? Okay, thank you. Okay, so just to provide a little outline of what I'll be talking about today, first I'll be mentioning some of the cardiovascular and respiratory mortality studies that have been conducted at OEHA and elsewhere. Then I'll move on to hospital and emergency room visits. Sometimes we're looking at some different populations between the mortality and the hospital or emergency room visits, so it's really important to look at both. Then I'll move on to PM2.5 constituents and sources and various health outcomes, and then mention some of the national studies that include California data. And then finally, I'll mention a meta-analysis, and that's something that could be used to combine all of these studies to come up with an overall effect estimate. Briefly, I want to talk about some of the methodology that has been used to conduct these studies. So short-term studies are typically time series or case crossover studies. So time series focus on a geographic area such as a county and take counts, mortality counts, for example, and then also line it up with the exposure counts. So if we're looking at something like PM2.5, we look at a county, mortality, PM2.5 exposure over a specified time period. And then the case crossover study design is similar to what we would call a matched case control design, but instead of looking for a valid control group, we're actually using the same individual as our control. And so you could imagine that a lot of these known and even unknown confounders are inherently controlled for by study design. And so that's really a strength to the study design, and it's really good for short-term exposures. Some of the data sources that we've used are air data from the California Air Resources Board, and of course that's the same data that the US EPA also uses. And then we've gotten some emissions data from USC recently that really helps us point towards some of the sources that might be connected with these health outcomes. So, and the outcome data typically are from the California Department of Public Health. That's mortality and birth data. And then from OSHPD, which is the Office of Statewide Health and Planning, they provide hospital and emergency room visit data. And I won't get into this too much, but if anybody is interested in the analytical approach for the time series study, it's mainly Poisson regression. A Poisson distribution just means that at the higher end of the tail, the outcomes starts to kind of taper off. And then for the case crossover studies, we use conditional logistic regression. Okay, so I'm going to spend some time going over these studies. So first, you could see that the study periods are from 1999 moving forward, and that's just because PM2.5 has not been available before that in California and throughout the U.S. In some parts of the world, they're still using TSP and PM10, and PM2.5 is relatively new. So you could see some of the averages that we have are 14 to 29 micrograms per meter cubed, and these
when we're looking at short term, it could be daily averages or sometimes weekly averages. The outcomes are respiratory for the first study and then cardiovascular for the last two studies. And actually, the difference between the last two studies is that the first one looks at just the general population, whereas the third study looks at some of the vulnerable population, and that's really important, as I'll show you in the next couple of slides. So the lag days are just previous days of exposure. So when I say lag exposure two, that means the previous 2 days of exposure. The average of 0-1 would be the same day, and the previous 0 would be same day, of course, and 1 previous day, and so forth. The results here are all expressed as a 10 microgram meter cubed increase. And so for the first value, we have the 1.30 percent. This is all, these are all percent changes. So percent change in respiratory mortality from a 10 microgram meter cubed increase in PM2.5. And in parentheses, we have the 95% confidence intervals. If the percent change includes zero, that means that it's not statistically significant. So I've here bolded all of the values that are statistically significant. And so just very briefly, you could see that the respiratory mortality outcomes have a higher effect estimate than the cardiovascular outcomes. But then if you look at the third study, it's actually very important to look at vulnerable populations because there are some important cardiovascular mortality outcomes for Hispanics, for example, compared to the white population. And also we looked at education. You could see that non-high school graduates have a much greater association than high school graduates. In fact, sometimes you see no association or even slightly negative association, although not statistically significant, for high school graduates. And then when you look at the less educated, you could see that that effect estimate is twice as high or four times as high. Okay. So again, now I'm moving on to hospital and emergency room visits. The years of data are now kind of limited by the emergency room visit data, which we've had available since 2005, and hospital visit data we have prior to that. But of course, we don't have PM2.5 data until 1999 or even 2000. And so that's why that kind of dictates our study period. Again, you could see the means of PM2.5. First two studies are emergency room visits. Last is hospital admissions. And here I want to point out that there's actually a couple things going on. It's important to look at the effect estimate. So the first two studies are percent change. The last one was not done by our study group, and they looked at relative risk. Percent change is essentially the absolute value of 1 minus the relative risk or odds ratio times 100%. So it's not; those are not directly comparable. So first, quite obviously, we see that there's a slight increase in ER visits, and that's for the second study that I have here is conducted in published in 2016. And then when looking at regional specific outcomes, that's very important as well. You can see that the South Coast actually has an increased association for hospital emergency room visits. But if you look at the Central Valley, there's actually no real increased association. Again, looking at a vulnerable population, this was a study done by the group at UC Irvine. And you can see when they're looking at children, and this was children 0 to 18 years of age, asthma hospital visits and a specific population in Orange County, I believe they had hospital visit data here. The associations are even greater. So a 1 day, you don't see any association. It's important to look at lags as well, because then you move on to 3 day, 5 day. And then once you get to the weekly average, you're seeing almost about a 10% increase. And that's, pretty astounding. Okay. So now moving on to cardiovascular mortality, and this is for PM2.5 species. It's also very important to look at some of the species. As you can see here, total PM2.5 in the first part of the figure has some increased associations, but then elemental carbon, organic carbon, nitrates, and potassium, which is further in the figure, and zinc have also increased associations. And sometimes even more increased associations. And it's important to look at these just because we could really focus on specific constituents of PM2.5 and also specific sources of PM2.5, as I'll kind of show you on the next slide. It's a little hard to read, but the main findings here, what I'm trying to show, is that if you look at PM2.5 constituents and some respiratory emergency room visits, there are some specific constituents that we've found here, and depending on the lag period, that we can really see increased associations, and those are copper, elemental carbon, iron, manganese, nitrate, organic carbon, potassium, again, silicon, titanium, vanadium, and zinc. Now, what does that all mean? Well, PM2.5 constituents come from multiple sources. And so just by, you know, pointing out elemental carbon, for example, could be due to vehicular emissions, which I think a lot of this is due to vehicles. But then there's also other, you know, it could be also due to oil combustion or biomass burning. So really, there's, you know, there's some overlap. And I know this was presented at our last meeting, at the last meeting as well. Okay, so what do we do with all of this data? Well, one of the things we could do is look at other studies that have included results from California. But as you can see here, I've listed the other studies, the other short-term studies that include California data. And many times they have counties or cities or communities. And so if you compare those studies with the California estimates, sometimes their studies actually look like the estimates are lower. But then once you get the California-specific estimates, which requires going back to the co-authors and getting those estimates, then they go back up. So when you're averaging over these large communities or large regions, you're actually missing the true exposure outcome association. And as I mentioned at the beginning of my presentation, you could take these studies and do a meta-analysis, which is just combining the results from several studies examining the same association to produce an overall estimate. So it's important, as I pointed out, to look at the effect estimates, if it's percent change versus relative risk, or something I didn't mention here, which is a populational attributable risk, or years of life lost. Those are different outcomes and can't be directly combined. This is not an economic evaluation, but I know the US EPA has taken some of our work and used BenMap to create an economic evaluation. So it can be done from these estimates, but that's not primarily what we do. We come up with effect estimates just from the exposure and outcomes. And then it's also very important to make sure that it's the same type of exposure. I showed you PM2.5 estimates and then PM2.5 constituents. Exposure metrics vary because we have daily exposure and then there's lag days and also sometimes weekly lags. Outcomes, mortality or morbidity, sometimes they're disease-specific, and I already talked about the effect estimates. And then the vulnerable subgroups, if we look at specific race, ethnicities, age, or regions, for example, you might find some higher risk groups. So in summary, there are quite a few studies looking at background, ambient, short-term PM2.5, and adverse health outcomes. It's also important to study some of these chemical constituents and important to study vulnerable populations. In this presentation, I showed some less educated or age groups make quite a difference to our effect estimates. Further studies are warranted for peak exposures because this is really, as I mentioned, short-term background risk. These are not peak exposure studies and associations outside the range of what we observe, or what we typically observe. And then long-term studies, which I didn't include here, are also important, but those include more adverse birth outcomes and cohort studies. That's a whole another set of literature that I didn't talk about, and I just wanted to point that out. Then there's animal studies, but while animal studies have a lot of strengths, one of the main limitations is that you can't look at real-world settings, such as when there is lower socioeconomic status or, you know, differences in demographics by populations. And so I also have not included those in this presentation. And finally, I want to just acknowledge our section and OEHA, our director, Lauren Zeiss, and branch chief, John Faust, who you heard from earlier, and then our air and climate epidemiology section. I have a couple people who have retired but have put a lot of work into these studies, so I also want to acknowledge them as well. So thank you so much.
Thanks for providing this information. Other questions here people have?
I guess I have one or two. Thank you very much. That was a very interesting presentation. Really learned some things there. Well, I just want to make sure I understand the lag days correctly. Sure. So if it's a lag, so there's a 3 lag day. Is that assuming there's sort of a 1 day of a critical exposure and then sort of seeing what happens 3 days later? Or is it capturing multiple days of exposures that are sort of cumulative over a period of time?
Yeah, that's a good question. Because when I have listed just lag 3, that's just the 3rd day. But if it says 0-3, then it's an average of same day, previous, 2nd, 3rd. So, yeah, okay. That's we look typically at both. Because sometimes it could be a cumulative effect, but then sometimes it could just be a very acute, you know, it takes some time and it's just, you know, we saw lag 2 and 3 could be.
Right, so just sort of a delayed outcome from a specific day's event.
Right.
Okay, so you're looking at both of those things. That's very good. And then could we add one other question, I think, which was on slide, it's the one that's the hospital visits. It's slide 5.
Slide 5. Okay, here we go.
And then, yeah, I was curious about this one just in terms of which ones you had indicated in bold being more statistically significant, I think is what you said, if it's bold.
Yeah.
But it's not immediately apparent to me why, say, the top one where it's 0.9 increase, but the lower bound does not go negative.
Okay.
I'm trying to understand what the threshold was. Why?
Yeah, I guess that one is marginally significant. So when we're looking at percent change, it's if it overlaps 0, the confidence interval, just because of the calculation that I mentioned. And then if it's an odds ratio or a relative risk, it's if the confidence interval includes 1. So that's why it's a little different.
Okay. I see. So if it's over 1, 0, I think I understand that now.
Okay.
Okay. Yep.
Chair Hayes, may I build on that particular question and slide? Dr. Basu, can you just walk us through carefully the chart on the right, asthma hospital visits for children in Orange County, and what the 1 day, 3 day, 5, I mean, it's building on what Tim asked, but just really help us understand what that particular graph is telling us.
Okay, so here it's not a cumulative lag, so it's 1 day, which means prior day exposure, and then you look at the hospital admissions for children in this example, and then you would do 3 days, so the 3rd day of exposure, or I'm sorry, the previous 3rd day of exposure, and then the hospital outcome, and then previous 5 days. So it just means that sometimes it takes a little while, what I was trying to show, before you see that increase.
So it's not 1 day of exposure, 3 full days of exposure, 5 full days of exposure, 7 full days of exposure. It's what happens on those days after a day of exposure. I guess that's the question.
Right, right.
I just
want
us to
be
really clear.
Either, but here I believe it was the actual day.
Just 1 day.
Yeah, that's
and then the effects might be seen 7 days later from that 1 day.
Right.
Whew.
Yeah, so that's why it's, especially with hospital admissions, it might take some time. I mean, mortality is usually a little bit more acute.
Okay. I have a question. Back on slide 4, the one previous to this one.
Sure.
4.
Oh, wrong way.
The other way.
I'm holding this upside down. That doesn't help.
There we go.
Okay, one more.
One further.
There we go.
That's it. I was struck by how different the results were for Hispanic and non-high school graduate cardiovascular effects than for other. Do you have any? I mean, what are we seeing here? I mean, is there something, there's obviously something important in this study that we need to understand if we're going to talk about how we're going to try to address issues in the Bay Area and perhaps in disproportionately affected communities.
Yeah, well, here it's really important to see that this is also the same exact population, because sometimes when you're comparing across studies, you could say, okay, well, there could be so many other factors, but this is actually the same exact population, same years. Now, you can notice that there's fewer counties, and that's because if you're starting to look at speciated data, there's only six counties with monitors versus nine for PM2.5. So that's the main difference. But otherwise, and that's why you see a little difference in the mean. But otherwise, it's really the same population, and it's important to kind of say that it's not just the association. So the exposure itself is different. So for these vulnerable populations, the exposure, there's been quite a lot in the literature to say that the exposure is greater, for example, for Hispanics versus whites just because of where they live. Yeah. So, and then you could also say that, you know, here we're looking at cardiovascular mortality. If there's also a difference there, then it's, you know, if there's more, we see that more in emergency room visits for the Hispanic population, for example. So then you would actually see a greater association. So, my main purpose of putting this up is to say that it's important to look at vulnerable subgroups because you might be missing important associations if you don't have them included in a risk assessment.
Well, you're expressing these results as per 10 microgram per cubic meter increase, and so that normalizes out exposure a little bit.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what we were trying to do, so you can compare across studies. And there's other ways.
So still, that looks, I mean, we're talking about the slope of the curve here. We're talking the dose response curve.
Yeah.
And this is it, I don't know that we can possibly know. I mean, but are we talking about, are there socioeconomic differences?
Mm-hmm.
Are there?
Yeah, these are markers of socioeconomic status.
Yeah, yeah. And is this a study that's been done by others, or is this a unique study that has focused in on this?
Yeah, there's definitely been other studies, but as I pointed out, there are and using the same data, but they are national studies or regional studies. And so we try to take those studies and really focus on California. But there's the estimates that we find in California are very similar to those national studies if we subset to California.
So what message should we take away from this one?
The message that I would have is to say that it's important to look at vulnerable subgroups or you're missing a lot of important associations.
Yeah, these are,
and that's ultimately what we're trying to protect by creating our standards.
In that study, the white category is not statistically significant. It drops below one.
Right. Yeah.
So it's only the non-high school graduate and the Hispanic group that pops above. Is that right?
Yeah. And sometimes we say it's not statistically significant because there's not enough population, but we don't have that issue here. So
where was this done? Was this Southern California or?
It was all of California. It's
all
actually done by our group. So familiar with this study. Yeah. All of these three studies were done.
Okay.
And, at OEA.
So I guess just to make sure I understand this one too. So this is showing a response to, you know, a 10 microgram per meter increase, in loading or particulate loading. And does it count then for the fact that certain groups work outside more than others? In other words, they're exposed more because they have construction jobs or as opposed to working in an office building, that kind of thing? Or
wish we had that data. So for all of our health data, we have residential address, but we don't have occupation or occupational address. So this is actually all based on residential data. And we end up combining by zip code or county or something like that.
It's just residential location is driving all of this, basically.
Yeah.
So do you suppose that if you then also try to account for workplace exposures, these effects might be even mm-hmm. greater?
Yeah, I think so. That's another vulnerable subgroup that unfortunately we can't look at mm-hmm. given our data. So, mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, this normalizes, this expression per 10 microgram per cubic meter normalizes it. So it's not a question, some people may be more heavily exposed than others, but the slope of the curve, the rate at which their response goes up per 10 micrograms per cubic meter should be the same.
Well,
regardless of whether they're getting twice or three times the exposure, because it's supposed to, the studies have shown that it's basically a linear dose response curve for PM2.5.
Yeah.
For this endpoint.
Yeah, more or less. It's not completely linear, and so that's why it's important. So especially when we look at the very high levels of PM2.5, and so then if, for example, Hispanics are getting exposed to those higher levels, it's not completely linear. So that's mm-hmm. something that right. I'm trying to show here.
Right, right. That's a big departure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's a very interesting study. I have a sort of a broad question. I mean, one of the things that we're trying to do. As we try to figure out beyond attainment, we try to think about the best way to move the public health needle. We've been wrestling with the problem of how you would take criteria pollutants like PM2.5 and put it onto the same balance sheet as toxics. You have different endpoints, you have different compounds. Do you have any insights as to how you might try to do that? How do you get PM2.5 and benzene or chrome 6 or butadiene? How do you get those all onto the same page?
Yeah, and those are tough ones, but there are some models now. UC Davis has put together some models for California. I believe they're 4-kilometer grids with some of that data, so that unless it's monitored, we haven't been able to look at it in the past. And so now we have some modeled data, so we can use that and look at health outcomes, but we haven't done those studies yet. So
yeah, it's a tough one because you have the hotspots program that has made a lot of contribution to improvement in public health from toxics in the vicinity of individual facilities. But we saw from the earlier presentation that Greg gave that the health effects of pollution here in the Bay Area are dominated by fine particles, PM2.5. Mm-hmm. So trying to understand how we properly combine and weight and take into account the toxics and criteria pollutants together becomes a really difficult topic. And I'm assuming that OEHA is thinking about that too and trying to do just that. And so that's why I was asking if you've got any idea as to how you stick PM2.5 and the toxics hotspots program on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And that would be the way is to model some of that data. So we have some, not all the ones you mentioned, but some of those in that data set, and we could start to look at that.
Okay, thanks. Do you have any insights in the in source attribution? I mean, you showed risks by compound metals and nonmetals. Mm-hmm. I don't remember where the slide was here, but it was very interesting. And it was also a summary slide where you showed where some of the larger risk drivers came from, right here.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, what we do really has to go back to something that we can try to change at the point of emission. And so understanding where the sources of the risk driver compounds, what they are, is critical to us trying to figure out where we need to go.
Yeah, so it varies by region. In California, we could say that in Southern California, a lot of it is from vehicles. And then here, we also have the vehicles, but we have some more from biomass burning and some other sources as well. So that it's also important to look at regional differences while we're considering this. But like I said, it's multiple sources. So it's not an easy question to answer, but it's important because we could at least narrow it down a little bit more than just looking at all PM2.5 or...
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Any other questions here?
Chair Hayes?
Yes.
I have a couple of questions. first of all, just a point on your practice here of showing data, even when it does not meet your significance level. I think that's great. So thank you for that. I think that's a great practice. You showed significance for elemental carbon appears to be important. Would you expect, and this relates to some presentations we heard at the last meeting, would you expect that it's likely or possible that adsorbates on that elemental carbon are actually a significant part of the health effect?
Yeah, we can't. So unfortunately, we can't break it down further.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But if we did, I suspect that it would be, yes.
And so then to unpack further levels of complexity, if we look at these other effects where you see metals and other elements, those might in fact be substrates that adsorb things other than what the elemental carbon is adsorbing. So in that case also, it may not be in fact that element. It may be the nature of what adsorbs on those particular particulates. Mm-hmm. So you would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting and makes, so to continue and make it even more complicated.
Exactly.
In fact, these little particles are tiny little catalysts, mm-hmm. right? So it's very possible that they're having different catalytic effects on the things that adsorb on them and may not even release until they're in the system.
Right, and that's why we also have a secondary.
I think we'll be studying this all for quite a while, I think it's fair to say. Well, so you would agree with those observations?
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's not a simple mechanism, unfortunately.
Yeah, that was a great question, Jeff. I know one of our members who is here, I think perhaps electronically today, but not in person, mm-hmm. is Mike Kleinman, mm-hmm. who's done a lot of work with just that topic, looking at the effects of ultrafine particles, for example, or black carbon as part of that. Looking at whether or not it's the particle, the core of the particle itself, or with what's absorbed on it, mm-hmm. that drives the risks. And there's some suggestion that I've seen in his work, if I remember it correctly. Mike's probably going crazy on the other end of the line, wishing he could pound the screen. But my impression was that, as one of our board members said, it's the frosting, not the cake. That makes sense from your experience.
Yeah, we haven't gotten into it, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much for coming. Boy, this is a feast of information and confusion. And I think that's fun. It's especially fun when that's the case. So thank you very much for helping to enlighten us and confuse us all at the same time. So thank you very much. We have reached the end of our second presentation here. It is 20 minutes till 12. It's certainly possible that we can continue on, and it's not inconceivable that we might finish this meeting before lunch, if we do. Or we could break at this point, have lunch, and then come back. Any preference?
I'd say push on.
Push on, is that all right? Okay, let's do that. Well, I'm item six, I think, on the agenda, if I've got this right. I'm on the chairperson's report. I'm not going to spend much time on this because I think we've already talked about this with Jack. I do think that there is a real value in increasing the opportunities that we have to get to know the board and the board to understand us a little bit better. We laid out a number of those things earlier. I really hope as we go forward on this that we'll find a way that works well for your purpose on staff, for the board's purpose most of all, and for us, because I do think this is a body that offers tries to get the science right. So does everyone, so we're not the only ones doing this, but certainly that provides a real value, I think, to the district, and to the extent we can increase that by increasing our interaction and understanding of each other, it will all be to the good. That's all I have on my report. That's fast. That's easy. So let me, at this point, we have a few more items more. We have public comment on non-agenda matters, which is our next item of business. Good, or not so good. It's always nice to hear from the public, but at this point we don't have any further. Council member comments. Did you enjoy National Toilet Day?
Yes, thank you for bringing that to
me. Thank you. All right. Thanks. So at this point, it's the time and place of our next meeting, which will be determined, I think, by some of the factors that Jack had brought up. Maybe indeed some opportunity to meet with the board that comes next, but we'll wait and see what happens at this point. It'll be early in the next year, probably February, March-ish. So with that, unless there's anything else that anyone wants to bring up, I think we are really done and historically soon. So thank you very much for an entertaining and interesting meeting. And it's good to see all of you, and have a very happy holidays and happy new year. We're adjourned.